Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Like it or not, the Bush White House approach to foreign affairs has been one of supersized activism. American power in the George W. Bush era is a tool to be used in ways it has never quite been used before, in revolutionary ways. Tonight on Point, the Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. But first, the U.S. government has indicated it plans to begin releasing prisoners from Guantanamo Bay. Vivica Novak is Washington correspondent for Time magazine and recently returned from a one-week trip to the prison camp. I asked her how many prisoners are to be released and on what timetable.
We hear that there's up to 140 prisoners who have been cleared essentially for release or transfer to their home countries. And when is the question? But we hear that it could be very soon. We hear that at least some of them could come this month. It's not clear that they're all going to be released at the same time, but that they all will be released fairly soon.
How many prisoners are at Guantanamo, and how are they deciding who may be in this batch to go?
There's about 660 detainees from 44 countries. What I hear is that they're taking what they call the easiest 20%, which are the people who really appear to have no connection whatsoever to the Taliban or to Al-Qaeda, at least none of any significance. Some of them have been in Guantanamo for 2 years come January. And the government has been extraordinarily slow in processing these people. Some of them were turned over for bounties that were offered by the United States over in Afghanistan. And you don't always know whether the person being turned in is indeed who you're looking for.
How are you interpreting the why of this? There are prisoners from 44 countries at the U.S. facility in Guantanamo. Are these countries putting pressure on the United States, or the U.S. has just decided, well, we've finally finished our interrogations, this is the outcome, these people can go?
I think there's a couple of things going on. We are definitely getting pressure from our allies, international pressure. There's some element of interrogations having gone as far as they can with some of these people. And I think the third element is the Supreme Court case. When the Supreme Court announced this fall that it would hear the case that has been brought by the families of some detainees and decide the issue of whether these detainees have any rights to challenge their imprisonment in federal court, which the government currently maintains they do not. Apparently, once the Supreme Court announced it would take this case, the processing of some of these detainees speeded up. And the releases are coming, I'm told, very much with an eye towards the Supreme Court's hearing, which will be in March or April.
Once these 100-plus releases get underway, what will happen with the prisoners? Will they be freed or will they be sent to prison in their home countries?
Well, I think it's a mix. I think a lot of them are going to be free, but there will be some who are sent to their home countries to be detained there.
On what grounds?
Well, because apparently we feel that they are not safe to release, and we are striking agreements, I believe, with some countries to keep them behind bars for at least a little while longer.
And what about the 500-some who stay behind? What's their fate at this point?
Well, it's really not clear what's going to happen to them. There are six people who have been designated as eligible for military tribunals, but they haven't been formally charged yet. I think that you'll see that happening fairly quickly, although the two British detainees who are among those six may be going back to Britain. We hear that perhaps Britain is striking a deal where all the detainees will be returned to Britain in some form or another. Nine of their citizens are at Guantanamo. But I do think you'll see some military tribunals starting up. Now, I don't think you'll be seeing very many people being subject to these military tribunals. I think that the majority of them won't. And so the big question is, what does happen to those hundreds of other people who are at Camp Delta at Guantanamo Bay? And we don't know that.
Vivica, we have to ask you about the broader picture at Guantanamo. There was a huge hullabaloo raised by the Army a few months ago when an Army Muslim chaplain, Captain James Yee, was arrested. And the suggestion was that they had uncovered a major espionage plot. Now, most of those charges have been dropped, and he's facing charges simply of having pornography on a government computer and adultery. Surely he's not alone in those things in an institution as big as the Army. What happened with that?
Well, it's interesting. I'm told that investigators were a little overzealous in that case, and that, in fact, a number of people in the military have been intimidated by the treatment of Yee, because if they can take what little evidence they had and make as much of it as they did at first, then I think, you know, a lot of people are a little scared about that.
But intimidated to what end? I mean, he was put in isolation. He was kept in manacles and leg irons. To make what point?
You know, at the beginning, they believed that they had more than they had. And then when it turned out that that was not the case, they freed him from pretrial detention. He's still facing a charge of mishandling classified information. And as you said, the adultery and pornography charges, which I'm afraid look very much like retribution. You still have the cases of two linguists at Guantanamo who are facing charges. One of them is actually accused of espionage, and it's unclear what's going to happen to them, but I understand that the task force that's investigating those particular security breaches are pretty close to concluding that they acted independently of each other and also independently of any foreign power or foreign group like Al-Qaeda.
These were Arabic translators, Arabic interpreters.
That's right. And then there was another arrest over the weekend of a colonel, which is pretty high ranking, who was charged with mishandling classified information. But it seems as though he is somebody who was simply caught up in the increased scrutiny as a result of the other cases. It doesn't appear that that one is an extremely serious case.
This is U.S. Army Colonel Jackie D. Farr. Vivica Novak, what's the overall impression you have of morale at Guantanamo now? The reports in recent months were that it was bad. Have they gotten it back on an even keel, or they just have a bad situation there?
Well, it's hard to tell, because when you go down there, you're escorted at all times, and you kind of see what they want you to see. I get the sense from the people I talk to that they are feeling okay about their mission. Two-thirds of the people who are down there are from the reserves or the National Guard. Nobody is down there for very long. The National Guard folks have been told to expect up to a year's deployment, but most of them leave before then. So I think they kind of do their time there and then they get out. But I never heard anybody who strayed from the party line.
Vivica Novak, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Vivica Novak is Washington correspondent for Time magazine. She spoke with me from Bethesda, Maryland. Since its victory in World War II, the United States has built and maintained a host of multinational institutions and agreements. By design, they helped support the American agenda around the world. They also served as an international system that, in no small part, legitimized American authority. From its outset 3 years ago, the George W. Bush administration has been dismantling that system in favor of American power unbound. Our guest tonight calls that radical shift the Bush Revolution. And George W., he says, is running it. Tonight on Point, the Bush Revolution with former National Security Council member Ivo Dalder. Can you see the revolution? How would you define it? Is it overdue or over the top? And is Iraq an example of its success or its failure? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Ivo Dalder, co-author of America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. In the mid-90s, he served as director for European Affairs on President Bill Clinton's National Security Council staff, where he was responsible for coordinating U.S. policy toward Bosnia. Good evening and welcome, Ivo Dalder.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Dalder.
Ivo Dalder, in a nutshell, what is the Bush Revolution?
Well, it's basically what you said in your introduction. For 60 years, the United States has pursued a foreign policy in partnership with friends and allies through international institutions and on the basis of international law. rather than looking at these institutions, alliances, and norms and rules as means towards achieving American ends abroad, this administration has looked at these as at best as irrelevant and usually as constraints on the exercise of American power. There's a strong belief in this administration that the way ahead and the way for the United States to engage abroad is to do it on its own, to rely on American power to the maximum extent possible in order to achieve the objectives that it has set, to look at alliances and institutions not as means to that end, not as things that enable you to exert power more efficiently and, in fact, more effectively, but as constraints on the ability of the United States to achieve what it wants. We don't need coalitions. We don't need alliances. We can rely on coalitions of the willing.
You present that in very measured terms, Evel Dalder, but you call it a revolution. I wish you'd give us a quick history lesson here. You quote John Quincy Adams in your book, in a speech he made 4th of July, 1821, of course, where he famously says that America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And warning against that, he said the fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty to force if she did otherwise, and that she, that is the United States, might become the dictatress of the world. She would no longer be the ruler of her own spirit. Put this, what you call the Bush Revolution, in a historical context for us, not just the last 60 years, but maybe it goes back further than that. Give us a sense of what the major camps in American foreign policy, the American view of the U.S. role in the world, and the U.S. Posture toward the world has been, so we can see why you call this a revolution.
Well, if you go back to the beginning of the history of our country, for a good century or so after Washington's farewell address, there was a general understanding that the United States could achieve its interests abroad better by being untangled but also uninvolved, that what we needed to do abroad is to be engaged economically but certainly not politically, don't be engaged in alliances or get caught up in warfare among our European brethren, but stay away. That was American foreign policy for most of the 19th century. We changed that in the late 19th century and into the 20th century with Teddy Roosevelt, Carl E. to the Monroe Doctrine, with the beginnings of a big stick, talking softly but a big stick, going abroad, undoing the maxim that John Quincy Adams that you quoted from John Quincy Adams about going abroad for monsters to destroy.
And being frankly imperialist and unashamedly there for a while.
Unashamedly so. But the real change, a fundamental change in American foreign policy, the revolutionary change, came with Woodrow Wilson, who, contrary to John Quincy Adams' belief that the way one needed to go abroad for monsters to destroy, in fact, one had to reform the monsters, one had to make nations free, make them more democratic, allow self-determination to flourish in the aftermath of World War I as part of the 14 freedoms.
But get a League of Nations together, some coordination.
Exactly. The important point that Wilson was is not only that you needed an activist foreign policy, but in order to have such a foreign, in order to constrain and not allow the imperial temptation that we had seen for a brief period at the beginning of the century to get out of control, to do that through international institutions on the basis of international law. And what Mr. Bush has done, just to complete the history, happened, of course, is that the League of Nations, which was the means to that end, was voted down by the very people that we are now finding in government to fund the same kind of thought, the notion that being constrained as part of international institutions was fundamentally wrong and making the exercise of American power too difficult. Of course, we then went for 20 years into an isolationist period. As we came out of World War II, the insight of Wilson that we needed an activist foreign policy, but that we should engage abroad on the basis of friendship and institutions and international law, together with others, to use those institutions as means to legitimize and indeed extend our power, and to maintain that power over a longer period of time, became the foundation of our foreign policy, Democratic and Republican.
And that basically was the foundation stone right up until the year 2000. We're going to come back and look at exactly how and why that was unraveled, you give George W. Bush himself, not just the advisors around him, the Vulcans, the other big names that we'll talk about, the credit. But Jack Beatty, Evel Dalder, looks along with Mr. Lindsay, looks into this situation and says, you know what, George Bush is not just a puppet on a string here. He's an actor. He's directing this show.
Well, that's a provocative part of his book, it seems to me, because I think the received opinion is the opposite, that he is, to a certain extent, the creature of his vice president for many people, and to some people, of his speechwriters. I just went back, for example, and looked at David Frum's memoir about Bush on September 11th, and it turns out that the Bush Doctrine, the idea that we will hold states responsible for even stateless terrorists operating on their soil, the idea behind the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, it came out of a speechwriter, came out of Mr. Frum's pen. No one said, put that in there. He put it in there. So I wonder, was it Bush driving the policy or the speechwriter?
We'll come back and look at who's cooking what. We're talking about the Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy with Evel Dalder, co-author with James Lindsay of America Unbound. You can join the conversation. Is it clear to you that George W. Bush has launched a revolution in foreign policy? How would you define it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bush Revolution in foreign policy, how George W. has remade America's role in the world. That's the contention of a new book, America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy by Evel Dalder. And James Lindsay, Evel Dalder, is with us tonight. He's senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. He was director for European Affairs in the National Security Council in 1995-1996, responsible for coordinating U.S. policy toward Bosnia. Author of 10 books on U.S. foreign policy, so he has paid attention. You can join our conversation tonight. Is the Bush Revolution overdue, or is it over the top? And was Clinton's Washington too ready to put its trust in multilateral treaties? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Evel Dalder, we're going to grill you on exactly George Bush's role here, but I want to get just a tiny bit more history first. I wish you'd take us from the end of the Cold War down this home stretch toward the Bush, the George W. Bush era, and the debate that was going on after the Soviet Union fell about what the appropriate role of the U.S. in the world was and how that should be pursued.
Well, that was an interesting time in which we coincided with basically the Clinton administration, in which we found ourselves looking around to figuring out what to do in the world. Of course, initially, we weren't particularly interested in foreign policy. Remember that Bill Clinton ran a campaign in 1992 on the slogan, "Is the economy stupid?" And as soon as he was elected, reassured the American public that he would focus on the economy like a laser beam. Mm-hmm. But surely, but surely, like every other president before him and in fact since him, he had became more and more involved in thinking about the problems of foreign policy. And what struck Bill Clinton most about the world that occurred after the end of World War II, after the Cold War, mm-hmm. was that the forces of globalization were fundamentally changing the nature and the kind of challenges that were upon us, not only positively in terms of allowing democracy to spread more rapidly and more widely than before and allowing prosperity to reach more and more corners of the world, but also negatively in terms of the spread of infectious diseases like HIV/AIDS. As we know today on AIDS Day, we remember terrorism, which was a preoccupation, particularly by the time of the second administration, the spread of weapons of mass destruction. And he believed that these kinds of challenges required a deep degree of international cooperation.
But this wasn't just a Republican-Democrat thing. There were many Republicans who had, ever since the end of World War II, as you say, been multinationalists themselves. They may not have agreed entirely with Bill Clinton, though some did. How did the Republican side of this equation spread out? What were the factions there?
You sort of had three, if not four, factions. One, which dominated the Congress, is a faction that we'd call the sovereigntist faction, a belief that anything that constrains American sovereignty is bad, that treaties were therefore and the United Nations were bad. This is the old isolationist wing of the Republican Party. It was led by people like Jesse Helms and Congressman, then Majority Leader Dick Armey. That was the congressional wing of the party, never very strong in the foreign policy elite. then within the foreign policy elite, you had exactly those people that you mentioned, the people who were relatively sympathetic to the Clinton administration. Call them the pragmatic internationalists. This is the foreign policy establishment. It's where Bush's father comes from. It's where Colin Powell comes from. People like Brent Scowcroft, who believed in not only in American leadership, but working that leadership through international institutions, through our traditional alliances to achieve our, in their view, somewhat modest international goals.
And this was the old mainline rudder of Republican foreign policy perspective, but there was another faction there.
Exactly. And then you had, in fact, the hardliners, which were divided into two camps, the neoconservatives. The people who believed that we needed to use American power, that it was now as strong and as large as it had ever been, to remake the world in America's image, to go out not only in search of monsters to destroy, but to turn those monsters into Democrats, into liberal democracies. That was one faction. The second faction were the traditional hardliners, what we in our book call the assertive nationalists, people who believed that American security fundamentally depended on the destruction of those monsters, on going after the threats that are out there, on dealing with the enemy as best and as strongly as we could.
So the Vice President Cheney as an assertive nationalist, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz as the neocon.
Exactly.
So who won that debate, or is it still unfolding?
Well, it is still unfolding. It's still certainly unfolding in the rhetoric. But up to now, if you look at the actions of the administration as opposed to the rhetoric, we would argue that the assertive nationalist won, in part because the president appears to be an assertive nationalist. He is someone who, when you really push him, it doesn't talk about the need to spread democracy, for example, in Iraq, but talks about killing the terrorists and the bad and evil people who are out there. That is what it's fundamentally about. Even as late as September 7th, when he gave his big speech to the nation, which was headlined with the $87 billion he asked for Iraq, his three main goals were, one, to get more foreign troops so we could have less American troops.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, to kill the terrorists. And deal with them as quickly as we could. And thirdly, to hand over Iraq to the Iraqis. There was very little talk, in fact, there was none in that speech, about democracy, about liberty, of the kind of words we have seen the last two or three weeks.
But, you don't leave it, Evo Dalder, at just the phrase assertive nationalist. You go on to use a term that I most associate with propaganda out of communist China. Hegemonist is your characterization of the Bush foreign policy revolution, the Bush foreign policy posture.
Right. It's a belief that it's basically a posture that says that power is all that matters in international politics, that those who have the most power matter, as the president might put it, the mostest, and that you need to pursue in a dangerous world power for its own sake. It's a traditional realist in many ways point of view about how how the world works, with one added ingredient, which is particular to this administration, I would argue to this president, that the United States, being the most powerful country, is not only a uniquely just great power, but is seen as such by other countries. There's a strong belief and a conviction, not only that the United States is a good country, a conviction I share, by the way, but the belief that no matter what it does, other countries necessarily have to view the United States in that light. And when they don't, they must have they cannot have American interests at heart. They must be against the United States. They must be, in many ways, its enemy.
And this is the piece that justifies preemptive war. But take us then right back around and justify your contention that the Wizard of Oz behind all this is not the vice president, not Rumsfeld, not Wolfowitz, not anybody else. It is George W. Bush, the guy from Midland, Texas, himself. How do you make that case, Evo Dalder?
Basically two arguments. One, the belief that George Bush is somehow a puppet in his administration is based on the argument that George Bush doesn't know a lot about foreign policy, something that he himself during the campaign not only repeatedly proved but also repeatedly said. We remember the pop quiz about the president's names and the names of
the president.
Named the president
of Pakistan and so on, yeah.
Et cetera, which he flunked.
Though you note that a lot of people in Washington gave each other that same pop quiz, even at the Brookings Institution, and not everyone was successful in answering those questions.
Quite the contrary. I don't remember anybody who had all four.
Right.
But you know, there's no doubt that George Bush is not a curious man when it comes to international affairs. He doesn't read the newspaper. He is not one steeped in the kind of knowledge that you and I might appreciate.
So what makes him the puppeteer, then?
Well, because knowledge isn't the only thing that matters. The other thing that matters is beliefs. During the campaign, he said an interesting phrase. He said, I may not know where Kosovo is, but I know what I believe. And everybody focused on the fact that he didn't know where Kosovo is. But he did and forgot to focus on the second part of that sentence, which was that he knew what he believed. And this was a man, and is a man, with very, very strong convictions. And what makes him likely to be the puppet, a tier, as opposed to the puppet, is the way he has structured his presidency. This is a corporate presidency. It's a CEO presidency in which he is the CEO. He has appointed the people around him who are the best and the brightest to deal with, to an unfortunate phrase perhaps, but in order to run the departments, to run the various divisions of this corporation. He listens to them for their advice. He likes them to disagree, in fact, openly in front of him. And he encourages that, but ultimately it's him that makes the decision. And when he makes the decision, it's his decision. It very much comes from his own convictions, his own way of looking at how the world has operated. To take the example that Jack Beatty mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. David Frum inserting in the speech the notion that states rather than just terrorists would be the focus of attack. In fact. What we know from Bob Woodward, and I've also found in my own research, that is a phrase that came out of the president's own thinking, that states had to be held responsible for a very simple reason. Transnational groups like terrorists are not high in the worldview of this president. States are behind everything. They are the ones that make the world work. And he is the one who together with Karen Hughes and Condoleezza Rice, without by the way, checking with Powell or Rumsfeld or indeed Cheney, insisted that this be in the speech, and thus was born on September 11 in the Oval Office address one major part of the Bush doctrine. But that doctrine was not something new or novel. It was perfectly consistent with how this president looks at the world.
It's a big claim and a big, revolution is the word you use in foreign policy. Evel Dalder, a lot of callers want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. Kevin's calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes, very enjoyable, and it seems to be great analysis of the history of American foreign policy and of the policies of the present administration. But the idea that if someone who's ignorant, flailing about, is in control, even though they may be destructive, I find problematic. I remember when Bush debated Gore, and Bush was under the understanding that there was no European troops in the Balkans, and that there were American troops in Haiti when that was no longer the case. So I'm just wondering to what extent, if someone is almost willfully ignorant of the world, and that they can have quote unquote beliefs, and that have consequences as his being president, but to what extent is that,
it doesn't make him the mastermind, you might say, Kevin. And I hear you're no fan there, but Evel Dalder, pick it up. Kevin describes the president as ignorant, flailing about, destructive, but it doesn't make him the mastermind, doesn't make him the driver, he says.
Well, I'm not defending the president's policies here, and the fact that I agree with Kevin. This is not a man who's deeply steeped in the intricacies of foreign policy, but it is a man who is very, very sure of himself, an extraordinary self-confidence. As one person who advised him both during the campaign and during served with him for some time in the administration said, it used to be that George Bush was in receiving mode. Today he is only in broadcasting mode. That is, he is absolutely convinced of the course he has set when it comes to foreign policy. It may be a wrong course. It may not be based on a lot of reading and a great understanding of how the world works, but it is nevertheless one that he's been pushing all along, and we would argue all along, and is certainly pushing now, with great effect, and that it is in some sense predictive. Take the recent change in Iraq. When faced with the question of whether or not to reduce American involvement in order to narrow the nature of the American mm-hmm. involvement or expand it, as the neoconservatives writing for the Weekly Standard would have it, what did he do? He followed the Rumsfeld-Cheney line, which said, let's do less rather than more. And there's a consistent element here in his foreign policy that if you look at how he – of what we believe his interpretation of the world is – you can have great predictive power about what the policy actually is, as opposed to what he says about it. Because what he says about it is written by speechwriters. It's not clear to me that he believes all of what his speechwriters write.
But watch what actually happens. You say, Kevin, thanks for your call.
As he himself says.
Yep, Jack Beatty. Here's a picture. The president has an array of perspectives coming to him, certainly not an infinite array, but Evel Dalder describes him as being in charge and that he chooses between these options. He chooses between Wolfowitz and Powell and Cheney and Rumsfeld. And Evel Dalder sees his personal stamp here.
Well, I don't doubt that this personal stamp is there, especially given his religious framework, which I expect we can talk about later. But, you know, what strikes me about Mr. Dalder's book is the continuity between Bush's worldview before September 11th and after. This revolutionary development did not revolutionize his thinking about the world. He had a framework which stressed that states were the key actors, and here we have stateless actors perpetrating this atrocity. And he had a view that power was the ultimate measure among nations. Mm-hmm. But he saw power as force. Well, just at the moment when the threat was becoming multinational, he saw this state-centered idea. And just at the moment when, above all, we needed to understand power as persuasion to deal with a multinational stateless threat, to get all the nations to cooperate and so on, he stuck by his idea of power as force, so that the revolutionary development didn't revolutionize his worldview.
Do you agree, Evel Dalder?
Yeah, I think Jack Beatty's exactly captured a central part of what we are arguing, which is that 9/11 was an enabler for the president to conduct a revolutionary foreign policy. But he had the means and motives well before that. His worldview was there. And we shouldn't be terribly surprised. Most people, when confronted with new facts, will try to fit those facts to the prevailing theory. They will not change the theory. That is a well-known psychological defense mechanism when we are confronted with uncertain threats. And so, indeed, a president who strongly believed that the way what makes the world tick is states and the power that states have, looked at 9/11 and what Jack Beatty and I might regard as a quintessential example of globalization and the transnational nature of forces that globalization has produced, negative in this particular case, he regarded as a manifestation of a state threat. And so they go around and, as they say, we quote in the book, Duck Fife, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, a major player in the Iraq War, who said our entire war on terrorism is based on the conviction that without state support, al-Qaeda will not be able to survive. Well, that's frankly not an argument that I would want to make. I don't believe that states were behind 9/11. In fact, it was the absence of states, like in Afghanistan, that allowed 9/11 to happen. It's the weakness of states, not the strength of states. But here we have it. That's why we went into Iraq in the end, because there is a fundamental belief in this administration, one that the president not only shares but pushes day in and day out, that states rather than the transnational network of terrorism is what is behind the threat that we face.
So correct,
and if we can get rid of the tyrants, mm-hmm. we can solve the problem.
So crack down on those states, and you describe this as something that didn't blossom after 9/11 but was kind of a view chomping at the bit all through the 90s, very disdainful of the Clinton administration's agreements with Europe, which they saw as just sort of throwing away an opportunity for great American power to shape things realistically and in its own interests.
Exactly. In fact, not only throwing away power, but needlessly constraining American power at the very moment that we needed to use it in order to reshape the world in a way that was more conducive to our interests.
Charles Krauthammer's memorable phrase, Prometheus playing pygmy, and the people around George W. Bush wanted no more of it, and they pretty much put that policy away. We're talking tonight about the Bush Revolution in foreign policy, how George W. Bush has remade America's role in the world. That's the thesis of the new book by Evel Dalder and James Lindsay, America Unbound. You can join the conversation. Is President Bush the puppet or the puppeteer here? Do you look forward to what Bush might do in the world in a second term, or do you fear it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. My guest is Ivo Dalder, co-author of the new book, America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. Ivo Dalder was Director for European Affairs in the National Security Council from 1995 to 1996 under Bill Clinton. He's currently at the Brookings Institution. You can join our conversation tonight. Who are the realists here? The multilateralists or the go-it-alone crowd? And how would you describe the instincts of the tough-talking president from Texas? Do you share them? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ali is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Ali. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
For a couple points of disagreement and a question, but really I'd like to make a brief comment about the Kosovo comment, not knowing where it is. I was watching the country music television a couple weeks ago, and Alan Jackson happened to be on, and his exact lyrics were, "I may not know the difference between Iraq and Iran, but I do believe in Jesus." And I'm like, well, thank you, he's not in the White House, but apparently he is, or at least the philosophy behind it. And the points of disagreement that I have, basically with the term revolution.
All right.
Yes?
Yes. We're all ears, Ali.
Oh, okay. The term revolution, basically, I see us supplanting terrorism, basically, for the Soviet Union. I mean, it's a 30-year-old doctrine, basically, that we're following, of go-it-alone internationalism, first followed under Nixon, then Reagan. I mean, I believe Bush does embodify it, but
Ali, how can you say, I mean, NATO was a huge multilateral institution in opposition to the Soviet Union. The United Nations, in some degree, was kind of a talking shop set up to contain the Soviet Union in part.
That's definitely true. But even to a certain extent, Nixon and Reagan both undermined the alliances that we had with NATO members and directly engaged the Soviet Union.
So you don't see it as a revolution. Ivo Dalder, how about it? Thanks for your call, Ali.
Well, there's some continuity. There has to be, after all. So many of the people who serve in this administration served in the previous administrations that Ali was talking about. But there is a difference. I mean, Nixon and Reagan, for all their willingness and wishes to go it alone, bought into in the end to the fundamental post-World War II consensus that the way ahead for the United States is to work with partners, to work with alliances like NATO. Certainly, Kissinger and Nixon were more pro-NATO than most. They, in fact, believed that American power was on the wane, that you had to work together with others in this world of growing interdependence and in order to deal with the Soviet Union through a policy of détente. Ronald Reagan came to office, indeed, more revolutionary in that sense, more believing in that in not only American power but the goodness of American power was essential to get ahead. Mm-hmm. But in the end, he worked together with the major European countries. He didn't undermine the alliance. He, in fact, worked very hard to strengthen it.
And Bush has been willing to go forward with essentially one, with the United Kingdom. I want to get a couple more calls, and our time is short. John's calling from Detroit. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on? I don't feel that there is a revolution going on. I think what is happening is that we're actually seeing what these other countries, specifically the European nations, truly feel and have felt about the United States. They're willing to let us flip the bill for most of their actions. They're willing to let us go in and put our soldiers on the line, let our men die for them. But when it comes time when we need them to help us with something that we feel needs to be done, they're not there for us.
John, we've got it. Let us pick it up. Ivo Dalder, how about it? John suggesting it's not the United States that's walked away. It's Europe that's walked away from the U.S.
Well, there's some sense that that's true. Clearly, the Europeans didn't step up to the plate, at least most of the Europeans didn't, when it came to the question of Iraq. But I would ask, why not? They did in 1991 when the French deployed an entire division, when the Brits, in fact, deployed more forces than they did in this time.
And when James Baker, Bush Sr.'s Secretary of State, worked his tail off to get them all lined up, visiting, what, 40-some countries in a few months?
Well, one of the big differences is they believed in international institutions. They believed in diplomacy. They actually went to foreign capitals and talked to them in person and worked the issue until there was a consensus. This administration doesn't believe in diplomacy. It doesn't believe, frankly, in the need of having allies. They believe that allies are constraints on the ability of the United States to inflict American to use American military power in particular. And they also believe that everybody would just follow them if once there was a clear success, that alliances are formed and coalitions are formed just by the United States leading. Well, one thing they found out in this case is that sometimes when you lead, particularly in the obnoxious way that this president has sometimes led, others will not follow. They may not oppose you. They may not be a balancing power, as realists in international relations think, but they may abstain. They may just say, listen, it's your problem, not mine. That's the attitude of the French and the Germans at this point. For all the problems that we had with the diplomacy on their side during the last 8-9 months, the fact is they're not going to join an operation in which they don't have any say. I can't blame them.
You quote the Chinese leader Zhou Enlai when he was asked what he thought of the French Revolution, and of course this was many years later, saying it's too early to tell. You were a Clinton guy, so we have a sense of where you're probably coming from, but what's your assessment of the Bush Revolution, the hegemonist approach, as you call it, these months, these years on?
Well, I think it is based on two fundamental flaws. One, we talked about a little earlier, the notion that states is the only thing that matters, that the forces of globalization can be ignored, and therefore that the challenges we face are those we can deal with the power of states as opposed to the power of international cooperation. And secondly, a fundamental flaw in this administration's approach is the belief that it doesn't matter how you behave for others to that all that matters is that as long as you have more power than anybody else, they will follow you. But in fact, they will not follow you if you don't take their interest into account. You will not be able to get the cooperation you need to deal with the international problems unless you are willing to talk to them, to engage them, to work the issue.
Our time is very short. A final question is this: if you're correct, is this self-correcting? Is President Bush likely to adjust course and balance the ship on your terms?
No, I don't think so, because I think what is driving this president is a deep conviction of how the world works. It may be wrong, but it's not going to work. It may be self-correcting because we have a political system that says that if this revolution, in fact, is heading for the rocks, we will want to change ship in 2004. And the real question, it seems to me, for the election that is coming up is whether the course that this president is on is one that is making the United States more secure, safer, or whether an alternative course is necessary at this point. That is the issue that we will find out in 2004.
Ivo Dalder, it's great having you, and you've outlined things in a most illuminating way. Thanks for your time tonight, and thanks for the new book.
Well, thank you, Tom. My pleasure to be here.
Ivo Dalder, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. Jack, I guess we are living in revolutionary times.
We are, and we have established a principle, the principle of preemptive strike, that is, I quote Henry Kissinger, it is not in the American national interest to establish preemption as a universal principle available to every nation. Because if everybody starts doing it, where are we? And if we say we're the only one who can do it, well, then what makes us the judge, jury, and executioner of the world? That is a revolutionary doctrine indeed.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, an acclaimed Israeli author tackles the question of borders. This is On Point. In Geneva, Switzerland today, self-appointed Israeli and Palestinian negotiators signed a sweeping model agreement, entirely informal, that calls for the creation of a Palestinian state and addresses many of the issues that have been roadblocks to peace between the two peoples. The so-called Geneva Accord is entirely non-binding, but those who signed it hope that leaders on both sides can use it as a template for bringing peace to the Middle East. Acclaimed Israeli novelist A.B. Yehoshua says the Jewish people have always been confronted by the issue of borders. In his just-published novel, The Liberated Bride, Yehoshua uses intimate familial boundaries to examine larger questions about political and social borders. Here, Yehoshua reads an excerpt from The Liberated Bride and discusses how boundaries have come to define his homeland.
I think that questions of boundaries is always a question that are imposed upon us all the time. What are the boundaries between us and our children? What is the boundaries between a man and his wife? All the questions of boundaries, when you cross boundaries, when you have to keep boundaries, all the question of culture is also the question of boundaries. But for us in the political and identity level, the questions of Israel is the questions of boundaries. And the question of the Jews is the Jews are all the time crossing boundaries. The Jews are experts of crossing boundaries. And Zionism is borders. If I have to define Zionism in one word, I say borders. Meaning you have a border, you have a physical border of your own, and in this border you are responsible to everything. And this is totally different from the historical life of the Jews that were moving from one place to another, not taking responsibility to the totality of the reality around them. So the questions also of boundaries between and borders between us and the Arabs, and this is, of course, the crucial question that is imposed now. I will read here, there is a great conflict between the husband and his wife about what to do with their son, Ofer, who had been divorced after 1 year of marriage and was still very much unhappy and could not renew any other relationship with another woman. And he did not tell his parents what are the reasons of his and breaking his marriage. And Rivlin, the father, who is historian, is professor of Orientalist, wants very much to know what was the reason. He thinks that by knowing the truth, he could help his son to overcome his misery. The wife, she is a judge, and she say, you don't have the permission to go behind his back and try to collect information about what was happening. Tell me, Rivlin sighed, shredding the invitation into little pieces. What will you do when I die? What? Who will subdue the chaos for you then? To his surprise, his death announcements no longer alarmed her. Don't worry. We will find ourselves another husband. But suppose he is not as talented and efficient as this one. We will train him, never fear. He smiled, taken aback by her fighting mood, yet determined to maintain his posthumous reputation. And if your new husband protests, quite rightly, that it is not his job, what will you do then? Ask your typist? I told you, it is not her job either. Then what? You will be lost. Why? She refused to accept the bitter fate foreseen for her. I can't change. What makes you think I cannot arrange my own desk? I only let you do it because I know how much you enjoy ordering me around. I enjoy ordering you around? He laughed at the affront. Really, what exactly do you think I get out of it? And who could order you around even if he wanted to? His enthusiasm for the task waning, he hurried to the near courtroom to look for another basket before the half-joking, half-deadly serious exchange could make him despair of the remaining paper on her desk. He had always liked passing through the narrow archway that led from a corner of her office into the dark, window-walled interiors of the courtroom, which, though not large, had a solemn and dignified air. Going straight to the bench, which rose massively above the rest of the cool, dimly lit room, he surveyed from the heights of justice the dock, the witness stand, the counsel's table, while deliberating in the Shabbat silence what verdict to hand down. How do you like it up there? She was standing by the witness stand, her hair massed, a bit childish-looking from his vantage point on height. There is definitely something appealing about being able to look down on everyone. but only if you are prepared to give them your undivided attention. That is something you are incapable of. I would give my attention to any person who was getting at the real truth, not just at some dry legal definition of it. I have endless patience for the truth.
Israeli novelist A.B. Yehoshua, reading from his new book, The Liberated Bride. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.